The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'll be reading from Volume 61, Number 1, the Fall 2021 issue, and the issued title is Resilience, Tar Heels, Tragedies, and Triumphs. It's produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. First article today, Quakers Face Challenges in Colonial North America. This is written by Dr. Joseph Beatty, who is Research Supervisor, Historical Research and Publications Office of the North Carolina Office of Archives and History. What is resilience? When historians think about the past, we look for how people or things change over time. We ask about what happened and how those events made things change. Sometimes those changes can be difficult, and people need to have resilience to make it through. Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines resilience as an ability to recover from or adjust easily to misfortune or change. Resilience means not giving up. How have you seen examples of resilience in your life? Maybe you know someone who has gotten sick or hurt and worked to get better. Another example could be preparing for a performance, recital, or religious ceremony. Lots of effort and energy go into getting ready and pushing through to make sure you are successful. But what if the historical change that someone experienced was large? So large that it affected not just individuals and families, but the whole community. This is what happened to the Quaker community in North Carolina during the American Revolution. They experienced powerful challenges that tested their resilience. Who are the Quakers? The Religious Society of Friends, also known as Friends or Quakers, was founded in England in 1652 by a man named George Fox. He wanted to make a new religion that focused on people having a closer relationship to God. Some people in England saw the Quakers as threatening and treated them badly. Because of this, many Quakers moved to the American colonies, first to Pennsylvania and soon after to North Carolina. How do you think early Quakers felt about having to move from their homes? What kind of resilience did they show? They had to travel several months across the Atlantic Ocean by boat just to practice their religion. The first of these North Carolina settlements was in Perquimans County in the northeast corner of the colony. Quakers began gathering there as early as 1676 and organized several meetings, their word for churches or congregations, in Perquimans County and Pasquotank County by 1700. Later in the 1700s, Quakers from Pennsylvania and Virginia began to move into central North Carolina, mostly in and around Guilford County. Some of the eastern Quaker families migrated there too, and together they started several new meetings. The Cane Creek Friends Meeting started in 1751, and the New Garden Friends Meeting began in 1754. These helped the Friends grow their communities in the central or Piedmont part of the colony. Soon, however, the American Revolution from 1765 to 1791 would begin to test the resilience of Quakers all across North Carolina. Why was the Revolution so difficult? The American Revolution was challenging for several reasons. The first was that the Quakers are pacifists, that is, people who oppose war or violence as a way of settling arguments or disputes. They do not support fighting. When the war started, many Friends refused to serve in the military, the militia, or in the army. Some colonists accused the Quakers of not being willing to make sacrifices to protect the colony. Another challenge was that the Quakers' belief in freedom did not allow them to use enslaved labor. Even by the time of the Revolution, slavery had become a cause for conflict among Quakers. The Quakers' belief in both pacifism and freedom made it difficult for them to fit in during a time when slavery was growing and fighting was common. The biggest challenge for Quakers during the American Revolution was that the war came right to the heart of their community. Soldiers from both American and British sides traveled across the colony to fight to gather supplies. On March 15, 1781, American and British soldiers fought an important battle at Guilford Courthouse in what is now Greensboro. More than 6,000 soldiers camped in the area outside Guilford Courthouse for several days before the battle. During that time, they took food, animals, and supplies from the people who lived in the countryside, many of whom were Quakers. One early part of the battle took place at the New Garden Meeting House, with soldiers fighting for almost an hour on the church property. Then the armies moved several miles to the courthouse, where the largest part of the battle occurred. What could the Quaker community do? They did not believe in fighting, but the war had come to their neighborhood. The Quaker community of Guilford and Newmarket showed their resilience by helping. The Friends used their homes and meeting houses as hospitals to care for soldiers who were hurt and sick. What is important is that they helped soldiers from both sides, believing that their job was, at all times, to assist the distressed. Both British and American soldiers arrived at the New Garden Meeting House under a flag of truce, meaning that they agreed not to fight anymore. The armies left very few supplies or doctors to care for the wounded soldiers. The Quaker men and women of the area had to do it all themselves. How did these examples help us understand resilience? At a time when the Friends must have felt a great misfortune, the community showed their resilience through service by helping others. They also needed to have resilience because of their opposition to slavery. The Revolution did not end slavery, and it was clear that slavery would play a greater role in North Carolina's future. Some members were forced out of the Friends because of their support for slavery, while others chose to leave to go to places where slavery did not exist. These families moved far away, many to Ohio or Indiana, to find new homes where they could find more freedom, including freedom to fight the institution of slavery. For Quakers in colonial North Carolina, resilience meant standing up for their beliefs, which may not have been very popular. They also had to make hard choices, deciding on how best to support freedom and peace, and sometimes they had to move far away to do that. Here are captions for the accompanying photographs with this article. An 1869 painting of the Friends Meeting House at New Garden by John Collins. The New Garden Meeting House was the meeting place of the Quakers, who had settled at New Garden in Guilford County by the 1740s. George Fox, born 1624, died 1691, founder of the Religious Society of Friends. Copy of a sketch of the New Garden Quaker community, Guilford County, at the time of the Battle of the Guilford Courthouse, March 15, 1781. Originally drawn by Jonathan Jessup, son of Thomas Jonathan, aged 10, 1781. Hand-drawn shows battle sites, buildings, property owners, roads, and natural features. Tourists view the statue of General Nathanael Greene in 1958. The city of Greensboro is named for the general who led American forces in the Revolutionary War's Battle of Guilford Courthouse in 1781. Postcard of the Guilford Battleground Park near Greensboro circa 1900s, early 1900s. The car helps date it. To the far right, you can see the Hooper Monument, which honors North Carolina's three signers of the Declaration of Independence, William Hooper, John Penn, and Joseph Hughes. Hooper's and Penn's remains were reburied there in 1894, but Hughes's unmarked grave could not be found. Guilford Courthouse National Military Park is a Revolutionary War battlefield that commemorates the battle between Major General Nathanael Greene's militia and the Continental Army versus Lord Cornwallis's British and Hessian Army on March 15, 1781. Continental soldiers did not wear formal, colorful uniforms like the British did. Here, historic interpreters Paul McKenzie and Travis Roseborough appear dressed as Continental soldiers during a reenactment at the park on Memorial Day 1993. Here's a sidebar article. Think about it. Early Quakers in North Carolina showed resilience by standing up for what they believed in. They refused to fight in a war, but they also looked for other peaceful ways to deal with the problem. They helped others. They cared for sick and wounded soldiers from both sides of the battle. It can be hard sometimes to do what we think is right, to stand up for what we believe in, especially if others don't think the same way. Has this ever happened to you? What did you do? Or think of a situation when you might have had to make a choice like this. What are some ways to hold on to your beliefs? Who can you talk to help for ideas? Here's another article adjacent to this main article. I thought it was always safe to do right. And there's a picture of Levi Coffin circa 1865. Many Quakers eventually left southern states for states like Indiana, Iowa, and Illinois because of their opposition to slavery. Levi Coffin, born 1798, died 1877 is one example. His father's family had emigrated to North Carolina from England in 1773 and was part of the large group of Quakers based at New Garden in Guilford County. Coffin is sometimes called the president of the Underground Railroad, but it wasn't a real railroad with tracks and trains. It was a secret interstate network of stations near the homes of abolitionists, people who wanted to abolish, stop, or end slavery. They provided safe places where enslaved people could rest, get food, and hide as they made their journey toward freedom. Coffin later wrote, "Slavery and Quakerism could not prosper together, and many of the friends from New Garden and other settlements moved to the West. In the early part of the ninth month, 1826, we took a final leave of North Carolina. My parents had immigrated to Indiana the previous year, and I was the last of our family to go. My family at this time consisted of myself, my wife, Catherine, and our son, Jesse, about a year old. We made the journey in light wagons with good teams and had a pleasant trip. We took the shortest route, called the Kanawha Road, and arrived at our destination in 4 weeks from the time of starting. We located at Newport, Wayne County, Indiana." This is from the reminiscences of Levi Coffin, the reputed president of the Underground. The next article is The Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians by Jennifer Wilson, who grew up in Cherokee, North Carolina, which is home to her tribe, the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians. Jennifer earned her degree in history from Western Carolina University and works at the Museum of the Cherokee Indian. She has dedicated her career toward educating the public on Cherokee history from a Cherokee perspective. Within the United States of America, there are 567 federally recognized American Indian tribes. Each tribe has a different language, culture, religion, and set of traditions that makes them unique from one another. The tribes are located across the country, and one of them is located in western North Carolina. The Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians is located in Cherokee, and it has been a federally recognized tribe since the late 1800s. The relationship between the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians and the federal government has always been complex and has often been filled with traumatic events for the Cherokee people. One of these events is known as the Trail of Tears. The Trail of Tears, roughly from 1831 to 1877, was the forced removal of American Indians from their homelands to an area west of the Mississippi River, to what is now known as the state of Oklahoma. This event was extremely traumatic for all of the tribes, including the Cherokee, who were forced to leave their homes. Many people died. The loss was incalculable in terms of life, property, culture, and traditions. There were some Cherokee people who were allowed to stay in North Carolina, and they joined with other Cherokee people who had either hidden themselves or returned from Oklahoma to their homeland. This group would become the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians. The Civil War came and split the Cherokee as much as it did the rest of the United States, with many fighting on both sides of the war. However, this turmoil did not prevent the United States from constructing strict policies for the Native American tribes. Known as termination, this policy was the official stance of the United States government and focused on completely assimilating the tribes and erasing their identities. To terminate means to put to a stop or to an end. The most effective tool of the government to enforce these policies was the boarding school period. Native American children were forced to go to these schools, sometimes kidnapped from their families. The purpose of the boarding schools was to strip the students of everything that made them Native American. Their hair was forcibly cut. They were forbidden to speak their native languages. They were no longer allowed to wear the clothing of their tribes, and they were often punished harshly if they did not follow the strict rules set for them. It is in these trials that we see the resilience of the Cherokee people and all Native American tribes. Throughout everything that was meant to destroy them, they held on to each other, their languages, cultures, traditions, and everything that made them tribal nations. During World War I and World War II, the Cherokee used their language to the benefit of the United States as code talkers. They were able to communicate orders and other information without enemy forces being able to translate their words. After World War II, the Cherokee in western North Carolina were experiencing an increased interest in their history and culture from other Americans. This meant tourists would come to the town of Cherokee, where the eastern band of the Cherokee Indians is located. These tourists would visit and purchase arts and crafts from local artists. The increased interest and demand in their traditional arts provided many Cherokee artists with the means to continue practicing their culture and traditions, while also supporting their families financially. This still occurs today, with many Cherokee artists creating pieces for many to enjoy and appreciate. The place where the Cherokee of the Eastern Band lives today looks much like any other town in southern United States, but if you come to visit, you will see the people and culture alive and thriving in a modern world. It will be in this way that you will see the resiliency of the Cherokee people, that through everything meant to destroy them and their culture, they still exist. The knowledge of who the Cherokee were and are still persists and strengthens with each new generation born. Through each hardship, the Cherokee maintain their identity and their community ties. This is what resiliency looks like to us. To learn more about the Museum of the Cherokee Indian, you can visit CherokeeMuseum.com. Here are captions for the accompanying photography. Freeman Owl, a member of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians, is a wood carver, stone carver, storyteller, and educator. He frequently presents on Cherokee culture and language, such as here at the American Indian Heritage Celebration held each fall at the North Carolina Museum of History. Owl's soapstone carving, Salagi and Creation, which tells the story of creation, is on view at the museum. For generations, Cherokee was only a spoken language until Sequoia, circa 1777 to 1843, invented a new syllabary to capture it and write it down. The language was once in danger of dying, but today many are working to preserve it. The bear sculpture, Sequoia syllabary, S-Y-L-L-A-B-E-A-R-Y, by Charles Sawnook, celebrates the written language and its inventor. Mary Wolfe, using mortar and pestle with her mother, Lizzie Tooney, sitting on the porch with Mary's children, Bill and Francis. Big Cove, early 1940s. Jarrett Wildcat, pictured in traditional regalia, standing in front of a bonfire at an event at the Sequoia Birthplace Museum on September 12, 2020. Indian Boarding School, Cherokee, circa 1909. There is another article associated with this. It's called Never Forget by Marvel Andrea Welch. Marvel Andrea Welch, MSW, CSAC, CCS, is a member of the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians and a North Carolina substance abuse clinical supervisor and counselor. She also serves on the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs, the North Carolina Cooperative Extension Board, and the North Carolina Indian Health Board. The Trail of Tears was a tragic event of suffering, injustices, and intolerance. Never Forget became the mantra of the 1835 New Echota Treaty, relinquishing our claims to our homeland. It was named the Trail of Tears because of the thousands who perished from disease and exposure to the elements during this time of capture, imprisonment, and finally removal to Oklahoma Territory. Missionary Daniel Buttrick, 1789 to 1851, wrote, "The government might more mercifully have put to death everyone under a year or over 60. Rather, it had chosen a most expensive and painful way of exterminating those poor people." The 175th Remember the Removal bike ride will forever be etched in my spirit. The annual bike ride, which began in 1983, retraces the steps of our ancestors on the Trail of Tears and is both a physical and spiritual journey. My daughter Chi and I sought to endure this challenge together in 2012. Chi was chosen and I was to follow in 2013. In 2013, the three-week journey would take us from New Echota, Georgia, over 950 miles, the longest route, through seven states to end in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Being a Cherokee has been a life of learning and appreciation of who we are as Cherokee women. The removal bike ride was a vision quest of understanding, being present, and experiencing the evolvement of the future seven generations. We as Cherokee people have persevered through the adversity of such a tragic history. Resilience in the now is to evolve in a good way into the future. To experience this part of history will never be forgotten. And the next article is Omar Ibn Said, Holding On to Who You Are by Yasmin Floden Ali, who is a religious studies PhD student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her research focuses on the history of Muslims and race. She has a background in interfaith and educational equity work. The walls of his cell, so the captain of the steamer related, were covered with strange characters traced in charcoal or chalk, which no scholar in Fayetteville could decipher. From the newspaper article, Prince Omero, Romantic Experience of a Princely Slave, a Strange Story of the Old Plantation Days, in the Farmer in the Almanac, 1884. This quote from a newspaper describes Omar Ibn Said, an enslaved man writing on the walls of his prison in Arabic. How did Said end up in prison in Fayetteville, North Carolina? And what was he trying to communicate? Omar Ibn Said was born around the year 1770. He grew up in Fouta Toro. Today, this area is in Senegal on the west coast of Africa. Said came from a wealthy family and he was very well educated. He memorized many books by heart, including the Quran, the holy book for Muslims, and long pieces of poetry. This was a standard education for people in his social group. When Said was in his 30s, he was kidnapped, enslaved, and transported to Charleston, South Carolina. He would never see his family again. After a few years in South Carolina, he escaped his first enslaver and went on foot to North Carolina. In Fayetteville, Said was captured and put into jail. He wrote on the walls in Arabic. We will never know what he wrote on those prison walls, but the look of his writing captured people's attention. James Owen heard about Said and purchased him. The Owens were a powerful, wealthy family. James's brother, John, was the governor of North Carolina. Said spent the next 50 years of his life with the Owenses until he died in 1863, just 2 years before the American Civil War ended. While with the Owens, Said wrote several pieces in Arabic, many of which we still have today. He is most famous for being the only enslaved person in the United States to write an autobiography in Arabic. In his writings, Said often quoted from the Quran and other works that he had memorized. Said's writings are complicated to analyze. Did he write because the Owens asked him to, or because he wanted to? How honest was he able to be? Did he have to worry about his work being translated within his lifetime? We will never have complete answers to these questions, but by analyzing Said's writing and the works and the books that he chose to quote, we can try and learn about his worldview. For example, he often quotes passages from the Quran that speak about how wealthy people who do not treat others with respect will be judged by God. We can guess that Said took comfort from these verses and imagined an afterlife where those who treated him badly would be punished. We can appreciate Said's education and the fact that even though he was stripped of his possessions when he was enslaved and transported halfway across the world, he still demonstrated resilience by retaining his own frame of reference and way of understanding the world around him. His entire life, he continued to draw strength from what he believed to be true. Here are the captions from the photographs that accompany this. Half-length formal portrait of Uncle Moreau, Omar ibn Said, circa 1850. This manuscript, written by Omar ibn Said, contains the 110th chapter of the Quran, Surah al-Nasr, which means the help or the assistance. This document was incorrectly labeled as the Lord's Prayer. In Said's lifetime, people thought that he converted to Christianity, but he continued to quote the Quran when he wrote in Arabic. He may have told the Owenses that this was the Lord's Prayer from the Christian Bible in order to be safe. The translation of the manuscript is, "In the name of God, the Lord of mercy, the giver of mercy, when God's help comes and he opens up your way, when you see people embracing God's faith in crowds, celebrate the praise of your Lord and ask his forgiveness. He is always ready to accept repentance." And lastly, stories from our collection. Here's a service banner circa 1943 to 1945. During World War II, it was popular to hang service banners like this one in the window of your home. Each star represented a person from your family who was serving in the war. This one belonged to the Whitlow family of Leesburg, Caswell County, who sent 6 of their 12 children, 4 sons and 2 daughters, to the war. Evelyn Barbara Whitlow, who served as a nurse in the Philippines, was among 77 Army and Navy nurses taken as prisoners of war, POWs, in 1942. They were liberated in February 1945. After the war, Whitlow married a fellow POW and moved to California, and she died at the age of 78 in 1994. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.